You're listening to the Fooled by the Root podcast.
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Heidi Marble. I'm really glad you're here to listen to this episode with the amazing Kate Murphy. She is an adoptee. She is a psychotherapist. And man alive, do we pack it in. We talk about grief and relinquishment and finding your voice, the guts it takes to get therapy. We discuss how to feel more comfortable in your body. I also asked Kate about her blog, where she speaks about the sixth stage of grief. And the way that she wrote about the stages of grief as they relate to adoption, it really just, it felt so good to be able to connect with that material and to be able to feel seen and heard in those stages. So if you have not checked it out, the Couch blog by Kate Murphy is amazing. We also went off on a little tangent when I shared with her how I dealt with my own anger as a young child. My mom would buy me these blow-up clowns that you would hit, and they would bounce back up, and you'd hit them again, and they'd bounce back up. I think it actually made me more angry, but we discussed how cool it would be to have an island where adoptees could go, where it was just smothered in these clowns that we could just beat the living daylights out of. By the way, that's not Kate's idea of therapy, it's mine. So I hope that you enjoy all the richness of this episode and the few breaks of humor that we weave in. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Fooled by the Root podcast. My precious friend, Anne Heffron, said, Heidi, you have to have Kate Murphy on your podcast. Kate Murphy is a therapist. And I can see why, because as I've been studying Kate, I'm so excited that she agreed and that she's here tonight to talk to me and to go over some things that I feel are really helpful and significant for those of us dealing with the issues surrounding adoption. Kate sent me her bio, and when I read it, it was in first person. And I thought, instead of me trying to twist it around, Kate agreed to go ahead and read her bio. And so, Kate, if you don't mind, we'll just start with that, and then we can dive into all the juicy questions I have written.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it. So I am many things, but all of those things started with adoption, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Plenty of all those things for sure. I am also a person who has had two careers. One taught me that I thrive on helping people, especially women, find their voice as leaders. The second career is the one that gave my life meaning. I became a psychotherapist at midlife. I find it a great privilege to support people who were adopted with the deep dive into grief that is caused by relinquishment and with their eventual resurfacing. I believe that it is possible to understand yourself better, take charge, rediscover your voice, and live with more purpose and joy.
Beautiful. Kate, thank you. Well, let's just go right to the first line. I am many things, but all of those things started with adoption. Wow. So why don't we just go over your story and summary, whatever you would like to share, so that people can understand your own personal journey.
Yeah, well, thanks. So I was adopted during the baby scoop era. I was adopted at 2 weeks old. Apparently I was with a foster mother, and this is my mother's story. A foster mother who was an older woman named Mrs. Flowers. That's what I've always been told, and I don't know if it's true. The reason I was always given is that my parents were in college, and so they had to finish school, and that's why they couldn't keep me. So this story was the one I had. And I really, you know, my mom was big on the minute I held you, you were mine, you were chosen. And I really, you know, that story I stuck to for very tightly for a long time. And I would have lots of daydreams about families and other families. And I'd constantly make up families, you know, but I really, you know, would always say, I don't need to meet them. I don't want to meet them. You know, if anyone ever asked, which of course they always did when you're adopted, you know, do you want to meet your real parents? So around the mid-90s, I thought about looking. And I had told my mother, actually, and she got in touch with the adoption agency, and she got information on the confidential intermediary program, which they have in Arizona. I think we've got Arizona in common. Yes. And I reached out by phone to a bunch of them and nobody would ever call me back. Then several years later, there was kind of some websites and I thought, oh, let me look into this again. And I, you know, fill out the contact form and it would go off into nowhere. I don't know. I would never be contacted back. And then in the, must have been early 2000s, mid 2000s, I decided that I would try to get pregnant with my wife, not wife then because it wasn't legal, but you know, that was coming. I thought, you know, I need to know my history because chances are we're not going to know the history of this, maybe other person, or we might adopt or who knows. And so I finally reached out to somebody and internets was much better than websites were much better. And the woman got back to me, you know, right away. And she had me read The Girls That Went Away by Ann Fessler. And I like cried my eyes out. So she was getting me prepared for kind of to be compassionate to my birth mother. It's interesting now in hindsight, I think there was nothing given to me to read about adoption and what I might encounter. She was very nice. And she found my first mother or birth mother right away, like immediately. And it was just so shocking to me. Yeah. And she wanted to exchange letters, but without any identification because she, you know, wanted to keep that secret at first. And then she was going to need to fill out some notarized information. I had to fill out notarized information to prove I was, you know, who I said I was. And she did too. And when that happened, you know, I had a gut feeling that this might happen. I think because of the secrecy about the letters, she just broke off communication. She said, don't contact me again. And so in 3 days, I realized that she didn't forget me, which was, I think, this fear I had that I didn't know I had. Because I was like shocked that she remembered immediately who I was, you know, of course she did. But, and then she was gone. And then, you know, they talk about coming out of the fog or, you know, whatever term you like, but it really was like, here you go, you're shoved. It really felt like being shoved out of the closet, you know, like, here's all the feelings and all the feelings really big. And the biggest one for me was really like, I was so angry. And it up until that point, I really wasn't somebody who expressed anger much at all. And it was this whole new, like I had no control. She was gone and woof. Yeah. So then I did a whole lot of research into what it's like to be adopted. And fortunately, I had a very, very good therapist at that time, not adoption competent. So she, of all of the great work we did together, that part was a little rocky, but at least I had somebody who cared about me and would support me in that way. And, you know, as best as she could, friends and wife and that sort of thing. But I don't even think I was able to really talk about it at that point. It was so shocking. And then fast forward a little bit later, and I had decided to change jobs and I thought, you know, I don't know. I think I'm going to need to figure some more stuff out about reunion because I want to work with people who are adopted. And around that time, I had a friend who did his DNA. He's not adopted, but he was like, oh my God, you know, I found these long lost cousins and all these people. And, you know, I was like, oh, okay, wait a minute.
There's more than just my mom out there.
Yeah. Tell me more. Yes, I can have this search in my own control, which, as you know, I'm sure as an adopted person, that feels much better. I can do it by myself and I can figure this out. And so that's what I did. And I eventually found maternal family. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I always remember I got all the stuff and that alone was just amazing. Right. That first time as an adopted person, you're like, holy shit, there's all these people I'm related to. Exactly. Yeah, it's just, and this is my ethnicity. And one of the biggest things for me, and this speaks to this genealogical bewilderment that a lot of us have, where it's like, who are we? And what is our hereditary, you know, or what's our ethnicity? And I found out I was actually Irish. And as a person named Kate Murphy, I went through life thinking I was only German and Swedish. And, you know, the first day of school, every blessed year of my life was like, oh, Katie Murphy, you must be Irish. And I was like the kind of kid that would be like, no, I was adopted. I'm German and Swedish, but I know my name, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, as an adult, I was just like, yeah, I'm Irish. You know, that's me. And I always felt so fraudulent. And then finally I was like, oh, for God's sakes, I am Irish. That's so, gosh, what a relief. With the help of my wife, and we just researched all the names, and I think over margaritas we found my entire paternal family tree, and we found out really, really quickly that my father had died, and he had died just a few years earlier. But so it was kind of like there he was, and then he was gone. So I think was probably the best way to find that out, because it didn't have very long to form this attachment that I would find him. And that side of the family was very welcoming. And I did a deeper dive to find maternal. It was a little harder, and that was a little more challenging when I called. And I really, you know, I went into it thinking, you know, I'm sure when it's just the two of us, she's going to be okay talking to me. You know, it will make it all better. And, you know, I called and was like, hi, I think, you know, the whole spiel. And she was like, no, I'm not your mother. I was like, what, are you kidding me? I know you are. I kept her on for enough time to say, hey, why don't I get your email and I can send you the information I have, like my non-identifying information, and maybe it will spark something for you, like someone else in the family, maybe. I don't know. Like 6 or 7 months later, she called me back and she said, well, as it turns out, I am your mother. And I said, I know. And we talked for hours, and I don't know, we've had contact, we exchanged cards. I mean, she's in my life, but it's a bit ambivalent. I mean, I was a secret to this day. You know, she never told her husband. She was told, you can either A, give up the baby with abortion, B, have the baby and be kicked out of the family, or C, and she really was in college, that part was true, or C, you can place your child for adoption and never speak of it again. Just that old, old story from, and it's just so sad.
Oh, yeah. It is, Kate. Thank you for sharing all that. I mean, there's so many parts about that really lead to the heart of your work. You know, grief is such a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I studied some psychology and, you know, you have the 5 stages of grief. But when I came across your blog, mm-hmm. and I read about the not 5, but 6 stages of grief and how you translated those into what that's like for an adopted person, mm-hmm. that was so meaningful and powerful for me personally. I'm sure it would be for many people, because like you said, it's like, not the sympathy, but the acknowledgement of the pain is directed almost everywhere else, but to the adoptee. And I'm sure you feel the same way. It's not like we want people to feel sorry for us necessarily, but hello, at least listen. And so I would love for you to speak about how you came up with the idea to not only revise those 5 stages, but then to add the last one, which for me really struck a chord.
Yeah. Yeah. So in doing work with adopted people, and I think, you know, most everywhere out there, whatever you read will agree, right? It's grief work. It's like 90% of the work you're doing with people is about grief. And, you know, I think what I find when people are coming into therapy so often is they're in this, you know, usually there's some degree of search and reunion that has happened, or they're thinking about happening or something. And there's just this, I don't know if you relate to this, but this sort of just bewilderment, or I'm feeling all of these things and I don't know why, you know, or you watch it go through with like, I just want medical history.
I didn't realize that was denial until I read it. I'm like, yeah. Oh my gosh, that is so denial, because I remember saying to myself, that's all I want. I just want a letter with my medical history. That was so much BS.
Yeah.
Do do any of us really want just that? Probably not.
No, no. And I actually think that's like an afterthought, and you want to tell people, you know, the reality is they may cut off communication with you. So don't forget to get the medical information, because you probably do want that somewhere along the line, but it's not the first thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and yeah. I think, I don't know if you can speak to this, but I felt like that felt safe for me to say that's my reason. It was protective, because I was worried what would happen with my adopted family if they knew I wanted more. It's really interesting that we start with the denial part of it, and that that is encapsulated in that.
Yeah. So when we think about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and that was way back, you know, like 1969, that she kind of pioneered this in her work with people who were dying, had terminal illness, and then later sort of translated that into grief and loss, and not just with the death of somebody, but the stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, and then later, and I'll talk about that, but meaning, and meaning work is very important. So she did a lot of the work on grief and grieving, the book, with David Kessler, and he has later written a book about the sixth stage of grief, which is meaning. What's really fascinating to me, so he just wrote that, it was like 2019, he actually was grieving the death of his son, who he had adopted through the foster care system when his son was four. And his son had issues kind of throughout his life, and he writes about this, I mean, that's out there publicly, but had some substance abuse issues and eventually died from what may have been an accidental overdose or may not. And that just, when I read that part of this book, I was like, oh, that shakes you just kind of to the core, because substance abuse and is such a rampant, you know, we're overrepresented in populations as adopted people. And so, you know, I just thought that was interesting. But in terms of giving a framework for people to understand what they're going through, I think it's helpful. And when we think about the stages of grief, it's really, really important to remember they're not linear. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, later, she was pretty, I think one of the sad parts of her work, she felt like people thought they were supposed to be these stages you go through and then you're done, like you wrap it up with a bow, I'm done grieving, which is not a thing, at all. And so we oscillate, you know, we go back and forth between one day we might, you know, wake up in denial again, like, oh, I want to just, and remember, I don't want to be adopted today.
I'm not adopted today. I refuse.
And the next day, you know, we might send out a text to a sibling that's, you know, part of our, you know, biological, our first family, and they don't respond. And all of a sudden we might be angry again. But really, it's just, you know, it's grief. It's like, why am I having this loss over and over and over again? The bargaining thing to me is always so interesting, because bargaining is a stage, and that's about the what ifs and the regrets. And I just think about the what ifs, you know, like, what if I wouldn't have been adopted? What if I would have grown up with this family? And there is just simply no space, at least that I know of, where as adopted kids or teenagers or adults, we're even allowed to talk about it, you know?
That's really true. I never thought about that, but you're absolutely right, because that is part of the process. It's part of the mystery of the ghost kingdom and all of these imaginary tangents that we go on.
Yes. And the narrative, which keeps us, a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us in denial for, you know, a lot, most of our lives sometimes, of adoption was the best case scenario, we're lucky, you know, this was meant to be, our lives would have been so much worse if we weren't adopted, you know, that there's no room for fantasy. It has to all happen by ourselves, you know, in our minds, all locked up. And that's not a way to grieve. That's not a way to think about things.
No, it's definitely not. I think that's where a lot of the conflict lies in adoptees' hearts, is because they know something's off, even when they're children. They're, we're very intuitive, and you know something's not right, but you're being, you know, told all these different messages that you're supposed to be in agreement with. Mm-hmm. And it is, I feel like it's a duality that we live in, mm-hmm. where it's just this interesting space. I saw a post where somebody said being an adopted person is exhausting. And I'm like, yes.
Yes.
Yes. So, no, I thank you for saying that, because that really, that'll be helpful to people to understand that, wow, that is definitely a stage mm-hmm. and something to acknowledge.
And it's okay to talk about it. Like, what would that have been like? You know? Huh. Yeah. And I think another piece that, so we've got these stages, you know, that kind of help us, I don't know, build some framework around what we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a name for like, oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. This is denial. Okay. Or, oh, this is depression. And when she says depression, she means sadness. She doesn't mean like clinical depression, you know? Mm-hmm. So, okay. Yeah. I'm sad today. I'm sad because I don't get to have the relationship I want with my, you know, first mother. Today, I'm sad because my adoptive mother is unhappy and won't talk to me about my loss. You know, there's so much sadness to hold. And it's normal. It's just normal. And the other piece that I think is really important to talk about when you're talking about adoption loss and grief is ambiguous loss. Are you familiar? You might be familiar with
it. No, I want to know more about this for sure.
Yeah, it's just so important. It was a term that was coined by Pauline Boss. I think she was in the 70s, 80s, something like that. But she was initially talking about absent fathers who are like physically present, but psychologically absent. Mm-hmm. And then she was, you know, kind of writing her dissertation, and she got funding by the military to do research on families that had kids that had gone and were lost in the Vietnam War. So the MIA, people who were gone, but they didn't know if they were dead. So it's this loss of somebody who is not dead. Or loss of a relationship, or loss, ooh. Right? And so that's all of adoption, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't have the closure to it. It's like this open-ended. Right. I see. So that's the ambiguous part, right?
Right. You know, doubt and uncertainty, and our brains do not like that. But you know, so you grow up knowing there's a family out there, and you might have a family that's great about talking about it, or you might not. But you know, they're there, but they're not dead. They're just missing. And, you know, she really maintains that this is the most stressful kind of loss that you can experience, because, you know, you're right. There's not this end. There's not an end. If someone dies,
well, it probably keeps keeps shape shifting, right? You can't put any parameters around it, where if somebody's gone from this earth, you can say they're gone. There's their headstone. They live from this day to that date.
Mm-hmm.
You have a picture. Whoa.
Picture.
That's crazy. I never thought mm-hmm. about the ambiguous loss part of it, and acknowledging the extra level of stress that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
That helps adoptees. I think when you say the word normal, that is so helpful. Not that I just want to be normal, but just to feel that the emotions that are coming up are not because we are intrinsically bad or flawed. These are normal responses to a very difficult situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Like a normal response to an abnormal situation. But there is something, I don't know if I have it. I want to say, hold on, let me see. I thought about it the other day. Pauline Boss actually said, and this is said very bluntly, and I love this. She says, when she's explaining this to people about many different circumstances for ambiguous loss, she has had people say to her, oh, the situation is crazy, not me.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. It's like we don't.
Revolutionary, Kate.
Right, we're not crazy. Yeah. And so, You think about it, family, you don't know where they are. You might have a country that you lost, your ethnicity, your, you know, might be your religion. you know, all of these and very important parts of identity are just sort of out there in the ether. And yeah, that's hard to make sense of. And so when you start, when you start coming to grips with that, and you talked about the duality, that's exactly it. It's, you know, I don't know who my mother is, and yet I'm here. And, you know, thinking about these statements that are just so paradoxical.
I really like the image you're giving, Kate, of kind of a structure for the grief. Not that you can make it one thing, but to know there are these pockets inside of this structure, and that we kind of move about them during the grief process. What is helpful, and I don't know, is maybe being able to identify those so that we can better understand our responses. So if we're feeling a certain way in the morning or whenever we're, you know, we hear something that upsets us, we can go, oh, that's this.
Yeah.
It therapeutically, is that helpful as far as managing all of these complicated emotions? Because it is tiring. And, you know, I love the idea that you say there's not an end point. And there was also something mentioned about spiraling. Am I spiraling up or am I spiraling down? And I feel like there's always this spin going on where you're just like,
yeah.
So I don't know if that was even a question. It's more of an observation, but I'm just curious about, like, how do you use the framework therapeutically to help everyone sort it out?
Yeah. I think anytime you can get clarity around what you're experiencing, if it feels confusing, it's grounding, and we can deal with what we can understand.
Yes.
And so if somebody's, you know, kind of all over the place, it's really important to be like, okay, let's just kind of stop. What are you noticing? What are you noticing in your body? What kinds of thoughts are coming up? What kind of negative beliefs are coming up? You know, can we put some emotions to these things? And we can start to feel like, okay, I got a tight chest. I'm feeling kind of panicked. Feeling confused, you know, whatever it is you're feeling. You know, we can think about, do some of these beliefs and some of these experiences that you're having, do they fit here? You know, are you sad? Are you just sad? You know, so often I think when we come down to what's at the core of what the feeling is, it's like, oh, I'm just sad. And that's absolutely, you know, grief, right? Or absolutely. I'm angry, or, you know, I think people are less confused when they're feeling acceptance, but I think those are beautiful moments too. And I think they're worth pointing out, like you're acknowledging that you have loss, and it's, you know, it's just there. It's not feeling really dysregulating, but it's, you know, it's there. And that to me is what acceptance looks like. It's not saying like, oh, I'm so glad this happened, and I'm so happy I was, you know, taken from my mother within moments of breathing. You're just saying, okay, it happened. I can fit that into my identity in its real state, right? Not in the rosy colored picture. Yeah.
I really like that. There's also something you said that really just struck my heart like a lightning bolt when you were talking about when you were angry, like the wound was just ripped open. Mm-hmm. And you all of a sudden are feeling things, and maybe you didn't feel you had permission to feel, or whatever those things are. So I'm wondering about that too, because as I'm going through the process of all of this personally, I notice that a lot of stuff pushes on the wounds really hard. Mm-hmm. And my past technique was to, let's go to Nordstrom, let's go to Dairy Queen, let's, like, you know, watch Netflix. And I'm telling you, Kate, I am turning around and I am sinking into it. And that is so terrifying, because I think I am going to either cry myself to death or feel myself to death. But, you know, what reassurance can you give that that is not a bad choice, to finally turn to ourselves and say, I am finally seeing the whole of the pain. Mm-hmm. And then a question to piggyback on top of that is, how do we keep ourselves from becoming the victim of all of it? because boy, that's a coat I like to wear and zip up, put a scarf on, and because I am pissed. So
yeah, and you deserve to be. Right?
I'm like, what do we do? What do we do? It's like, girl, you're supposed to answer all this in a half an hour.
Right, right. Well, first off, with the anger, I think one, right, there's kids who knew from the beginning, they're like pissed off and angry and having tantrums because they were like, something is not right, folks. Mm. I always feel like those kids were in touch. Exactly. They were labeled like the behavioral problems, right? But so they've had to learn how to shut that down because they were feeling too much for everybody. And then there was the more, you know, standard, this kind of good adoptee who was like, whatever, I'm fine. I don't care. And so, but if in both cases, I feel like it's getting reintroduced to anger. Anger is a normal feeling. Like, it has value. It has lots of energy. We can get stuff done with anger, right? But yeah, letting yourself sink into it and, you know, yeah, feeling it. And an important piece there that I think is part of this too is learning how to validate your emotions and have compassion for this anger so that you're also reparenting yourself. Because somebody should have been like, oh, you're having a tantrum. Tell me all about it. Do you want to scream some more? Go ahead, just scream. But it's like, you're going to be okay. That's the nurturing part, right? You're going to do for yourself, like, and it's going to be okay. However that sounds authentic to you, you know? But it's, you know, I don't know. It's just remembering it's okay. If I want to say if you're in anger too long, you know, maybe it's, but no, there's no too long. These stages are your own. They're unique and it's all normal. And yours might be a little bit longer, a little more unique, but it's still normal.
Yeah, it's so nice. We don't have to check a box and say, okay, we can only stay in this stage for this long.
And actually, one thing I want to add, this friend of mine that I had met through doing this work, she said something that always sticks with me. And she was, you know, my age, so we were like early 50s, probably at this point, I think, or maybe late 40s, I don't know, somewhere in there. And she was like, I needed a year off of my life to be pissed off. This is what we should all get.
Oh, we could have like an island where we could just have tantrums that would be totally like acceptable.
Come and scream. And
that would be, no, I mean, it feels like that's just providing the space that's needed without interruption. Like, you could just go for it. Yeah. No, I think, you know, it's so funny, Kate, because my mom, I did have a temper, by the way, when I was growing up, but my mom, my adopted mom got me one of those clowns that you hit and they come back up. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I used to kick that thing's ass on the regular and it made me so mad because it would hop up and be smiling and I'd just be on it. I can't even imagine what that looked like, but maybe we could have those on our island.
That is perfect, yeah. My sister was the angry one. She had one of those.
I like how this is going. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I think just to think about that, it sounds like acceptance of the feeling and the space that it needs and being able to provide that space if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the part, because there's so much suffering, Kate, that's happening. And I know for me being in my 50s, it's like, oh my goodness, I want to know what it feels like to have some semblance of peace. For the sixth stage, the meaning, boy, that is really great because we have to work through our own pain clearly. But can you define for us what that means in terms of adoption, the way that you have said it structurally?
Well, it's coming and it can happen at different stages along the way too. I think that's really important. It's not like it only comes at the very end of this very arduous process.
Right. Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. It's making meaning of the loss and finding a way to acknowledge the loss and find a way. And this can also be very large or very small. That's important too.
Good point.
Have some transformation and have a shift in perception and the way that it's kind of incorporated into your life. You know, I think about you doing this podcast and you know, I don't know if you feel this way, but to me, that's making some meaning out of your experience. You know, you're making this platform where other people can come and share their experiences. Does that resonate for you or?
100%. It has been life changing, life changing. Yes. Yes.
I feel like I've heard your voice change over the time you've been doing your podcast. Do you?
Absolutely. And it's really interesting. I was talking to some of the members of my team, and there's something about it now that just feels so sacred and so safe. I'm kind of getting out of my own way. And it's actually that acceptance, Kate. I'm saying I'm going to show up 100% who I am, not trying to modify anymore.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, turn the channel. Maybe that's defiance, but I think so often when you're adopted, you have to show up and be something that you're not. And I think that it's an opportunity to be authentic and to also provide that space for others. And for me, that is a huge gift to receive. I mean, I feel humbled to have the honor to sit with people and to hear their hearts and to know that that is having an impact, because I know before I started the podcast, hearing these other voices out there, those were lifelines to me. And if we can do any of that for anyone, that is the meaning, you know, in the suffering, right?
Yeah. And what you said, right before you said it might be defiance, but you said I'm showing up as myself.
Yeah.
Like that's the work. And yeah, you don't have to pretend, and you don't have to pretend like, you know, adoption was this gift. It just was. It happened. And maybe there was a reason. Lots of adoptions happened they all happened for a reason, but maybe some good, some not as, you know, who knows. But anyways, they happened. And yeah, for us to be able to sit in it and sit within ourselves and be ourselves unapologetically. I mean, that's some meaning. That is lots of meaning.
And you know, to pass it back to you on that note too, it seems to me, especially reading about, you know, you shifting careers and doing this, I'm certain that it's the same feeling that you get.
Yeah, just to provide space for someone to, have all their feelings and just be listened to deeply for as long as they want about every little bit of what they experienced with adoption.
I love it. And you know, there's something else I read that you said, it takes guts to get therapy. Boy, are you right about that. Can you explain what you meant by that? Because to me, and let me see if I'm right, it's about being vulnerable, like really vulnerable. And some of us, that's tricky, you know, tricky business.
For sure. I mean, I remember my first therapy. It's a long, long time ago.
You're like,
I was like, you know, I use this performance plan at work for my team, and it works really well for keeping us on track with our goals. And you might want to use one of those so we can really make sure we're staying on track. I just remember the therapist was like, you know what, if that makes you comfortable, you can kind of keep track of that on your own.
That's awesome.
Very well protected I was. And and getting vulnerable and really, you know, building a relationship with somebody that I could actually connect with and make eye contact even, like, that was a big deal.
Well, there's so many elements to that part too, because, you know, as you pointed out, and we all know that listen to a lot of, you know, information about adoptees, that we're overrepresented in mental health, that we are showing up and we are trying to figure out how to heal or work through these very painful things. And I think being able to talk to therapists who are aware of, you know, adoption issues is really powerful and important too. And I'm just glad there are podcasts and books and groups and things to help people too, because affordability can be an issue. And that's a whole nother podcast. But You know, I think that's why there's many ways that we can secure some healing for ourselves. But certainly that's really hard. And when you say finding our voice, Kate, can you speak about that? Because, you know, you said that's really important, helping people find their voice as leaders.
Yeah. So I think so often, and you know, I work a lot with anxiety and a lot with people who are high achievers that have adopted or not, that have, you know, it's not why they've come to therapy, but they have roots in childhood trauma and some very extensive trauma and some not as, but it's really made an impact, of course, on who they are. And this feeling like you're trying to always say what you think other people want to hear in order to be accepted, in order to be, you know, wanted. It just muffles out what's real. And you really can't get ahead in life, you know, with relationships or at work or, you know, anything. You just can't be heard. And if you can quiet that stuff down, kind of like you just said, you know, I'm just saying what I want to say, whether you like it or not. You know, I'm showing up as me, and it's frightening, especially when you're got so much armor built up and so much anxiety around. If I speak my truth, you know, I'm gonna have a panic attack or whatever. I just can't do it. And so, helping people figure out who they are, and helping to have confidence to speak loudly about what you believe, whether it's loudly in volume or just in, you know, confidence, but it's that part is to me the best part of the work. When I, you know, it just is so humbling and it's so fantastic when I see people figure out what they want and go after it and, you know, say the hard things to the people in their lives. And you know what? They usually get good responses because, you know, if people know what you want, a lot of people that you surround yourself by will want to give it to you, but you've got to be able to say what it is.
That's so true. And you have to feel that you deserve it, not in an entitlement way, but just in I exist and my existence matters way.
Right? Yes. Like I'm worthy.
Enough. Yeah, I don't have to be off to the side anymore. That's really, really interesting, Kate.
And what a piece of this too. And if I'm left, it's okay because I've got myself. Mm-hmm. Like that's a huge piece. Like I can let go.
You know, that's a really great point because I think rejection and sometimes we'll do anything just not to be alone. But isn't that really lonely after all?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, that one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's another point as we begin to wrap up that I read and I was like, oh, dang, this might be a good tattoo. Impatience is not a productive partner. Well, Kate, that news sucks because I want everything yesterday. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, patience. Oh, my goodness. You know, I think we want these quick fixes. We want to feel better now. We don't want to sit with our pain. This is a human experience, but certainly when you're adopted. Ooh. So what can you speak about that particular statement?
Well, one, it's born out of learning. But because I could certainly be that way. But I think, and this is the thing with therapy, with going through the grief that is adoption, is that, yeah, this is the long game. This is wanting to rush through and am I at acceptance yet? Am I over this yet? Am I healed? No. This is like your permanent partner, but you're going to learn so much along the way, but you got to hang in there. And that part is so important. I want to be over this like yesterday. I mean, I get that, but yeah.
Just not how it works, is it? And another thing that I would love for you to speak about too is I think a lot of adoptees feel this way, feeling more comfortable in your own body. Like sometimes I wish I could unzip. I know this sounds gross, my skin, but I'm just like, oh, I can't be in this anymore. This torture chamber that is myself. And I think that you know, can you give us a little window into how does one begin that process? I know it's a long process that requires patience, but what might be an exercise or something we could do to kind of feel a little bit more comfortable in these bodies that we've been given, that have been relinquished, and goodness knows what else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, goodness knows what else. That's true. Yeah, that is so true. I'm just, what came to me right there when you just said that was this idea of, you know, we've come into this family, and families are families. And so in some cases, they're really great and secure and lovely. But oftentimes you're just layering on more and more trauma. And it's hard to pull apart what was adoption, what was the family trauma. The easiest thing I can think of that works is when you're feeling a very, very strong feeling and you feel really kind of activated and uncomfortable, mm-hmm. is that you allow yourself to sit and get curious. What am I really feeling? And mm-hmm. if you're somewhere where you can actually like sit in a chair or stand, maybe it's standing, but feel your feet on the ground, kind of push down one foot, push down the other, and really feel that pressure. Like you're literally grounding yourself. And if you can, sometimes you can't, but if you can, breathe very, very deeply into your belly. It's just a deep breath, but it makes such a difference. Breathe deep, deep, deep into your belly and hold it. And when you breathe out, when you exhale, like really exhale, because your body's in the midst of feeling like you're in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. Like you think you're about to die if you don't keep, you know, going. And you want to signal to your organs that think you're trying to run away from like a lion or something. You want to signal to them the crisis is over. And so you're starting to get control over your body and starting to get comfortable in your body. Like I can manage this body. It doesn't have to manage me. Does that kind of make sense?
I love that. And that is a really, not to say simple, but it's applicable. It's something that's manageable, that we don't have to go somewhere special.
If I could add kind of one more thing to do, if you can remember, please. So I do EMDR therapy, and that's a different topic that I think mm-hmm. other people have talked about. But one thing from it is this butterfly hug. So you're kind of hugging mm-hmm. yourself, and you're going to tap one side, tap the other side, and find a rhythm that makes sense, kind of tapping one shoulder, tapping the other shoulder back and forth. What this does is it stimulates both sides of your brain and it calms you down. And so, you know, like when your kids were little and they're crying, and you pat their backs, like, stop crying. Yes. You're doing that same thing. Yeah. And so it's, again, it's this kind of reparenting and getting where we're soothing our own self, and we're showing compassion for our own self. I think over time we get more and more comfortable just in our own bodies. You know, things will still pop up. We're human. We live in the world, but we can get a lot more comfortable.
Oh, Kate, I could talk to you for the rest of the night. Is there anything that you would like to add? Anything that you'd like to expand on? Anything that you would like to say to hopefully, you know, we're being listened to all over the world, which is mind-blowing. Wow. And it's so exciting to think about that we are this community of family who is really sitting around the table with each other on a global level and just saying, I'm really interested in what you're doing and what your story is. So just kind of knowing that as a concept.
You know, I would say this. I think so many things can be healed through human connection. And I think as adopted people, connection is very, very hard and scary for lots of us. And if you can find a way, and it can be in a Facebook group, find a way to find at least one person that you can talk to openly and honestly, and who can support you in, you know, when you get a picture and you want to say, look, I found my mom, and someone can say, you have her chin. Like, this is the most healing thing ever. It's this connection with people who really get you. So mm-hmm. that would be, I guess, my last words. Yeah.
Kate, that is so, I felt that. That was amazing. Thank you so much. I can't wait to like go to our island with our little clown.
and scream.
And the margaritas. We need to have margaritas.
That's good too. Yeah.
Kate, I thank you so much. This was an incredible experience to have with you. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us more because, you know, there's lots of other things to go over for sure. So hopefully we can swoop back around at some point.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kate. I appreciate it. And everything you're doing. My God.
Oh, thank you, Kate.